Angie has asked me to talk about the precepts, and it's a very, very huge topic, and I got pretty caught up in it there. I just barely made it to the Zendo, but that's not even half of it. I think I'm interested in the precepts, my personal study right now seems to be more from the ideas of Mahayana Buddhism and our Zen Buddhism, especially my first teacher and many of your first teacher, Angie's teacher, Kobin. And through Kobin, Ehe Dogen, I happened to bring two books, maybe three Buddhist books with me this summer. And one was that spiral notebook of Kobin's talks that's near the water cooler. It's, every time I read it, it's something new. It's such a great opportunity for me because a lot of those are talks given when I wasn't present later on in Kobin's teaching when he had moved away from the Bay Area. And then I also moved away. I'm so grateful for those teachings. And Dogen has been something I've been studying since I first started sitting, basically the same fascicle is the Ginjo Koan. And I brought with me for study a student of Uchijima, who was also a contemporary of Kobin's. They had the same Zazen teacher, Koda Sawaki. It was Okamura, and he's still teaching now. He wrote a book called Realizing the Genjo Koan, and it's pretty amazing. He ties in Dogen's Genjo Koan with Dogen's lecture on the Heart Sutra, and they were written within a few months of each other. I didn't know that. I could also say that the precepts remind me and are closely related, I believe, to the Bodhisattva vows. So there you have where I started. But I think I'll take it from my first encounter with the precepts just a little bit. Soon after I began sitting in the Santa Cruz Sangha, I was able to move into the community there, the house that Kokyo is now living in. I think there were four, five, or six at some times of us in that little house right next to the Santa Cruz Zendo on School Street. And being in that community, we had sort of little in things we were talking about, and a certain shared way of thinking. Some of you at Tikoji may recognize that, I don't know. But one of the things I remember, I think when I first moved in, there was another woman with a child living there. And her child was a year younger than my child, so my child was two, and hers was, I guess, one, a little over one, and my child was a little over two. And you know the precept, no praise or blame? Well, we said, well, maybe, in fact, we were young and we were quite certain that, yeah, this is something we really need to use in our bringing up our children. No praise, no blame. It didn't last long, fortunately, for our children. I mean, especially the praise part, the blame part, of course. But, you know, to me it seems like the precepts first have to be taken to oneself and understood for years and years. And certainly not holding to fixed views is always good advice. And holding to fixed views of the precepts can be, well, has to be a mistake. Inevitably is a mistake. There was another thing going around then, not exactly the precepts, but a word tossed around, and it could have been included in the precept about no sexual misconduct. I'm not quite sure, but the word was attachment. And it's like, I'm not attached to the idea. People still say that now, you know. Well, you know, I'm not detached to that idea. Or in our terms, though, we were quite serious that, you know, I feel very attached to whatever, my boyfriend, or I feel attached to my child or my mother, or, you know, things that are normal human feelings and emotions, and that's wrong. I mean, and that is encouraged too if you read some translations of some of the old Buddhist texts, like Tozen. I was shocked to hear in one of the in transmission of the light, left his mother. This was in China. And I think perhaps this was used as an example of what you have to do, because it was a very strong filial duty in China. That's just my own interpretation. But he was praised in this book we're reading for leaving his mother, who had no other source of support and who ended up begging on the streets. And even though she came knocking on his door, In the monastery, he wouldn't go out and see her. So, I mean, we came by it a little bit honestly by some of the old teachings we took to apply to our own lives. Again, it kind of, if it's not harmful, aggressively harmful, it is not doing good if you think that that is what attachment means. I think our attachments in a more basic level are what Angie was talking about. I think Saturday, our attachment is to our idea that we ourselves and our views and our constructs are the whole picture. Okamura calls it our basic self-centeredness is the base of our delusion. And Dogen says, those who, I want to get it right. Those who greatly realize delusion are Buddhas. And he also says, those who are deluded within delusion are sentient beings. So, we're not one or the other of those. And yet we're the whole part of it. We're part of the whole. We are the whole. So I'm interested, as I said, in the Mahayana precepts. And I'm interested in the three pure precepts and Bodhidharma's version of the 10 great precepts. And those are the ones, the 10 are the ones we usually hear about and discuss. I don't think I've been in a Buddhist group that wasn't discussing those quite seriously, and it is a serious matter. I also want to mention, before I start that, is that we are lucky now to have this time sitting to have more space to allow our understanding of the precepts to widen. It's a very vast field. We are human beings on this earth, and we're surviving. And yet we're living in what Bodhidharma called this mysterious, profound Dharma. Mysteriously profound Dharma. One way to understand thinking, non-thinking, and I've come up with several little ways, but one way that I just thought of is that this mysteriously profound Dharma is with us always, and so is our individual self coming to us, our thoughts. Maybe it could be a matter of just changing focus, you know? Like we tend to be very adjusting the lens, as you used to have to do, on the thoughts coming in and out, and either trying to get rid of them, trying to be better, trying to endure, whatever we need to do to what we think get through this, or to avoid this, which could be a human problem, of course, like no sexual misconduct or no being angry. But we can also, in this more vast space of Zazen, allow that. Allow those emotions, if that's what's going through, you can allow those, but let them settle in that vast space without worrying them like a dog worries a bone. You're simply an open expression of the whole picture. And that's my theory for today of that. My experience today, though, was funny because, well, it's been the whole sesshin of Uchiyama, Okamura's teacher and Koban's contemporary, always talked about in his books, return to Zazen. And he liked to draw diagrams. And so here you have sleep here, and you have busy mind here, speculation and all this. You're always coming like in a zigzag. You're always coming back to Zazen. Well, I think right when I think now, who knows, because it stops after that when you're back to Zazen, you don't know you're there. But I think when I'm entering the gate, it would always come back as Casey would waltz with the strawberry blonde and the band. And it's been going on since Friday night. But it does play on. So now I think it's time for me to talk about what I had planned to say. So we have the three pure precepts. Embracing and sustaining. They start with embracing and sustaining. Yeah. Embracing and sustaining right conduct. Embracing and sustaining every good. Embracing and sustaining all beings. Thought it was interesting, Koban mentioned, and I never knew this, that or realized it in our meal sutra, right after we put the spoon in the big bowl, and we also put the chopsticks in the second bowl, I think so. So he says the first bite is stopping all evil deeds, the second bite is doing all good, and the third bite is saving all existence. It says that right in our meal sutra. I don't know if I grabbed that, but I looked it up, and it actually says almost those exact words. So he puts it in terms of bites. And then there are the 10 prohibitory or grave precepts. And Koban says the pure precepts and the grave precepts aren't separate things. They're just looking at things from a different angle. And Koban's translation includes Bodhidharma's version, which is basically the same in front of each one. So I think I'll read them without Bodhidharma's introduction, and then you can hear it with Bodhidharma's introduction. No killing life, no stealing, no attachment to fulfillment, no illusory words, no selling the wine of delusion, no praise or blame, no hoarding materials or teaching, no being angry, no abusing the three treasures, which is Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. And to give you an example of Koban's translation of Bodhidharma's version or understanding, for the first one it would be, self-nature is mysteriously profound. In the truth of the Dharma, there is no killing life. And the third one of no attachment to fulfillment is, self-nature is mysteriously profound, not to give birth to attaching, to loving, is called no desiring. Fu in yoke, no wrong, no scattered desiring. Koban also said that our doing Zazen is the fulfillment of all existence, and all, including all these precepts. On the other hand, that doesn't mean it's all taken care of when we get up. It's always done. On the other hand, for us, I don't think there is for the deer that we saw the other night, or that I saw when I went to visit Koban's memorial, or the bear that came to see me when I was sitting Zazen in the forest. Well, it was an open area in the forest. That was a puzzling experience for me, because I was sitting Zazen. And actually, it's happened before. Balin and I have had animals like coyotes once, when we were sitting in the woods, come right up to us. So this, I didn't know what it was. I heard this little footsteps coming in. It was not even as noisy as the deer. Well, there weren't leaves there. It was very soft, and it was not treble enough to be the chipmunks. I didn't know what it was, and it happened so fast, I actually had no time for thought. I just sensed this looming, probably my peripheral vision. If it was Balin, he was right in my face. It was like this. And I turned and I go, what? And the bear, which, it was small, I could tell that, but I can't remember the first moment, just the what, because it ran instantly. We went loping down the small hill part of the mountain. And I just kept talking about it. I said, I can't quit talking about it. Before I left for Sashin, I sent to some of my friends, a book reviewer's analysis of someone else's analysis of, but it gets to the good part now, one of my favorite poems by Elizabeth Bishop called The Moose. And it's a very long poem, and it's about a group of people in a bus, and it's in the Northeast, and the writer is very affectionate. The poet is very affectionate toward everyone that's on the bus and describes them, including an old couple in the back just talking to each other quietly, as if they were snuggled in bed under a quilt. And the houses they see as they're going by, the farms, the backyard, the scenery, it goes on and on. It's a long poem, but at the end, the bus has to stop, because right in front of the bus, filling the entire small road, is a moose. And everyone was making comments, oh, look at that one, boy, those are big horns, and we didn't want to run into that, you know, things like we do when we're at the zoo or something. But she said at the end, why do we all feel this sweet sensation of joy? And what I liked about the reviewer is that she points out that in this poem, and I also know in other poems by Elizabeth Bishop, she writes about epiphany as many nature poets do, but she has singled out because she writes about communal epiphany. And it just so much reminded me of us. I didn't feel that with the bear. It was a whole nother thing. I actually didn't have time. I wasn't afraid of the bear. It's probably only a year and a half old. It was big. It was a big bear. But it was, I just felt kind of the regret that we normally feel, I think, at the separation. Because that's all I experienced was the separation. I was visited. And then I did what any human would do in the interest of survival, without thought. What? I mean, I didn't lash out. I did that once at a bear that was trying to get at my toothpaste in Yosemite Valley. That's a really bad idea. People have been killed doing that because the bear just reacts too. Luckily, this bear was just curious and ran away right away, but I did feel that separation. And maybe the epiphany that we feel. She didn't mention that the moose felt that. She doesn't know. We don't know what the moose is feeling. I think, was it Dogen that said, only a fish knows the mind of a fish? So I wanted to share those experiences with you and basically my own exploring. And certainly during Zazen, I have been feeling my, let's not call it violation, let's call it experience of some of these precepts. And I found that it's really for one thing, as our friend Klaus once said to another friend who was breathing too loudly, he said, I wish you would stop breathing so loudly. You're ruining my sashin. So I could say it was ruining my sashin, but I wouldn't ever say that. No, it wasn't ruining my sashin. It was wisdom coming to my sashin. It was wisdom of experience. And my body took care of it. There was no thinking it through and admonishing myself. I guess the precepts have made their way into me, into my Zazen. Well, they're there and they're included. Everything is included. Enough for me not to go into praise or blame of myself. Praise or other blame, or to go into blame of myself as compared to others. It didn't go either way. It's just like, this is anger. I don't need to think about it. I can feel it. And I just felt it. And went on my way with Casey, and the Strawberry Blonde and everything. And then it was handy because I needed something to talk about today. And I wasn't going to go into repentance other than something I talked, because that's a whole other thing for me. I think I've done enough, haven't I? Almost. What Angie was saying the other day about allowing our emotions into us. Allowing our emotions without dwelling on them or necessarily even believing them. Now, these are my side comments. Admitting them in the sense of opening a door, come in, or you're coming in anyway. So the admitting of our mistakes, you could say, or our mistaken views that these precepts express. We have to be accepting of them enough to have it come to us from our natural wisdom, and this is Angie, what to do. If we act without this, if we speak without this, and we can especially notice in Sesshin, and as Copen said, we find ourselves digging a deep hole, a very deep hole. So I think the repentance is a chance for, first of all, in our own self, just acknowledgement, not blame, and acknowledgement to the community during our ceremony. Thank you. Are there questions or comments? Free?
This isn't really a question, but the descriptions of animals. I had an experience when I was sitting on Vancouver Island once in a tiny one-person tent. And it was so tiny that my head hit the ceiling.
Yeah, yeah.
And a crow came and landed on my head. And it stayed there for like 5 minutes. And it scared me initially because it had these talons that were a little bit...
Were they coming through the top of the tent, or was it actually in the tent?
No, it came and landed on the top of the tent. It
yeah.
Didn't, I think it
yeah,
didn't
the talons.
Was the first, I don't know what it,
yeah,
you
yeah.
know, but it liked it. And I was like, cool. So we just stayed it out, and then it flew away, and I like raced to the door to see what bird it was.
Isn't there a female goddess, does anyone know, with a raven on her head
yeah.
or something?
There is.
Yeah.
From Crete. The mother goddess from Crete.
The mother goddess from Crete. And is it is a raven?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It could have been a raven, too. Part of Ptolemy part. That's great. Yeah, we have a tent like that. You can just barely sit in it. If you're on a Zafu, you know, just barely sit in it. But.
And my golden retriever used to sit with me.
Come
into the room and sit down beside me and
stare at the wall.
He's like 20 minutes, just like.
Sure.
Well,
maybe
you can help me with this. Maybe not. When I did Jukai originally, the precept was no praising self at the expense of others.
Mm-hmm.
Here it's no praise, no blame. And to me, I sometimes kind of struggle with it because it's like, well, okay, not blaming, I can see that, but no praise seems kind of like foreign. That can be harmful, and so is this precept about, do we work with it literally, or is this a metaphor, what do we do with a precept like this?
Well, I was grateful when I heard it expressed as no raising oneself by putting down others. That makes more sense to me as something that I actually do probably more than half of my life when I'm awake. That would have helped me, I think. I don't know which one did I take. No praise at all. Is that the one?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Sometimes so, it's no praising self and blaming others.
Yeah, because that's what it amounts to. When you are putting down others, it's just a way of making yourself feel good. And another group that a friend of mine belongs to, and she told me about this, is taking someone else's inventory. And that always makes us feel better, right? No, I don't do that. So, you know, different angles. We've got translations here, too. But in Bodhidharma's sense, There is no, in this mysteriously profound self nature, there is no praise or blame. In this zazen we're doing, in this whole existence, the whole existence, the prajnaparamita, it's also expressing that.
Does that mean that we should never praise anybody?
That's up to you. No, I'm saying that Bodhidharma says it's not possible for there to be singling out, I think. But it's also something to keep in mind. No, I thought it was a great mistake to not praise children. I mean, it can be taken to an extreme, and blaming, that's something that we probably do more in our own minds, I hope. So it's not an answer to your question, it's just...
Just following up, could it be that it seems that Koban's precepts are all about no self? So praising and blaming would indicate that there's an existent self, an intrinsic self. So perhaps, do you think maybe he's pointing out that there's no intrinsic self to actually praise or blame someone else?
I've never heard him come out and say that, but yes, just like Okamura is saying, we have to realize that the basis of all our delusion is something we can never escape. So it exists, our self-centeredness. And yet, it's not the only thing. And when we're talking about, he says that the precepts are... Koban says the precepts are, what the precepts express are Buddha's mind. They are awakening. They are Buddha's mind.
Another way of thinking or saying it, and that show up in Bodhidharma's precepts, is that there is no self or other. That's basically what all of them mean, that we posit that there's something out there and there's me.
Right. And that's the source of all our longing and all our problems, is our basic delusion that we're separate.
Yeah, I'd like to add to that a little bit as well. It being there are levels where there's no self and other, and then there are, like you said, not holding to fixed views and more superficial levels, because in language or in communication there are things that can be called praise and blame, but then those things are depending on context or culture. So where I come from in China, indeed, praise and blame are seen very, very differently. And if you read the Zen stories too, there's not that much praise going on. So we have cultural codes as well. So then we are in this culture, and then we need to learn how to use the language or the communication in some way that is appropriate for the situation, for the selves that are involved in those situations. So I come back to what you said about simply not having fixed views. It's not easy. It makes much more hard work, it seems
does.
To me.
But, on the other hand, it's able to relieve all suffering, and it's true, not false.
Paula, could I just offer just what you said about the bear story? It's lovely, and In the Native American path, they would say that you have their medicine.
I'm on it then.
One of the precepts you mentioned was not to hoard material objects or the teachings.
Or teachings.
Yeah, and so material objects seems fairly straightforward. But what does it mean to hoard the teachings?
Okay, I really never understood that, but I'm just going to go for an image that's coming to my mind now of someone who is self-absorbed and surrounding herself with this wonderful stuff, and it's got a really tight grip on it. I think. Instead of realizing that it's freely given and it's freely coming and freely given. That's just an image that comes to my mind. Other people probably have.
Is it like not sharing a good recipe?
Yeah, I mean, you know, is that your state of mind? Like, this is my cookie.
It's really good.
Yeah. Well, speaking of which, Emily, we have to talk, and you too. So.
I really appreciate your discussing how it's challenging for you too, the precepts and that path that you're following, not just being with it, or, I don't know, opening the door and it just comes in anyways, whether you invited it or not, to be with it. There's something I wanted to share that I'm looking at. Teresa of Avila has trained her, a long time ago, trained her nuns. In this way to go into a castle inside, and I've been practicing that, and it's really helpful because each of those precepts, you have a dialogue with yourself in your own inner mansions in the castle, and there's a book about it by Carolyn Miss, and it's so helpful because you go into your meditative practice with this idea of working out your precepts, and just knowing these are all challenges, these are very... there's a fine balance, only there are triggers, you know, these things, these precepts. They're challenging to look at, but if you go inside these mansions that hold each mansion holds a precept that you dialogue with.
It's really interesting.
I found it very, very helpful and still very challenging.
Yeah. Now, what room was I in? I probably couldn't remember the room. I've heard of memory palaces where people had to keep track of things. They'd put each thing in a different room, similar, but yours is more challenging even.
I have a little request. Sorry to mention, Hector's a wee bit hard of hearing, so if folks are asking questions, can they do it nice and loud? He's only catching little bits.
Okay.
Yes, David.
You mentioned in the middle someplace of allowing, which I like a lot. That's central to my session so far, because I've been raised with the Ten Commandments and lots of guilt and shame around it, which is not allowing. And I can't get rid of them very well, but I can remind myself to allow what is. Anything to say about
that? Well, no, not really, but Angie's the one that said that, I think, in terms of repentance. First, I think she was talking about emotions or whatever. You allow it, you don't chase it away because, you know, it's not going away, right? But also it just came to mind, it's coming into my mind a little ditty from the from the Metta Sutta, what is that in there? Allow all things, or is it another or something? All things to reside freely, or something? All things to move and turn freely? No, that's still good. Anybody help me out here?
Well,
there's something that's going through my mind about allow all things. Is that in the Metta Sutta?
It's probably Genji Paul.
Yeah.
All living beings, whether weak or strong.
Well, it actually has the words allow. Yeah, it's probably from the Genji Koan. Okay. Thank you for that. Yes, Victor.
I understand what you say about praise for children. I have a child. But adults, I'm not quite sure. Do adults need praise? I mean, is that a good... I'm not quite sure. I haven't got the question thought out properly, but do adults need a lot of praise, do you think, or do they not need praise, or does it depend on the adult?
Well, I think you probably know by your experience.
Hmm.
It is such a dichotomy there that it's, you know, it is hard to work with, but what do you think? Like you said, it depends. Mm. That sounds good.
Well, I notice I don't praise a lot. And so maybe that'd be good practice.
You're Chinese Zen master there.
I'm pretty good to criticize that. I got that one down. The guy in the other way, my wife praises me a lot. But when I'm mad at her, it just like goes, I just like, yeah, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But when strangers praise me, that goes in. So I like that.
Mm-hmm.
It creates it creates a connection with the other person.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a good way of connecting with someone. Yeah. I think it's to do with, I like the aspect of sangha in Buddhism. I think it creates sangha.
Yeah, and you can feel it without expressing it. Peter?
I was going to say that having been married most of the years...
Oh, could you speak up a little?
Having been married most of the years since 1965 to three different women, I've learned that increasingly that praise is important in every relationship.
Praise more than the third one?
Yes. Yeah. And last.
Well, if you put it that way, I agree.
You and Valen have it down. You've only had one marriage, and that's...
Oh, no. We've just had two marriages. You just didn't hear about the first one. Samya.
So, no blame. We're talking about the negative stuff, right? We're trying to put other people down probably by inflating ourselves. But do you think it could be... praise, like when we try to fish for a compliment, like praising other people to make them like us just for that reason, rather than offering the praise freely.
Right.
Like even if you turn around and gossip at me, I'm still going to like you.
Right, yeah, that sounds very familiar, very familiar. Yeah. Okamura
really.
Says...
Or is it more than that?
Well, both, I suppose. But Okamura says that even if we're honest with ourselves, even if we really do a wonderful deed, we're very helpful to someone else, at the basis, if we're honest, we can see that we're kind of like, yeah, you know, I did good for that person. We're getting something from it. So.
Boy, I'm really confused now.
Well, maybe you don't do that. I would expect you wouldn't do that, but I do. Like, if I do something, and if I do something spontaneous, then it's a whole another thing, acting out of your zazen or whatever. But sometimes I'll find myself, you know, in the same way of praising someone, because to deflect perhaps their dislike of me, or before it's even started, or something like that. Mm-hmm. And it's just a matter of being honest with ourselves and seeing that we're doing it, and it's not a crime. Does that answer something like that? What do you think when you do that? You've noticed it.
Well, I really never thought of it, to tell you the truth. You know, you feel that, you know, you kind of know what's right, unless one is really full of themselves, and that's scary. But, you know, talking about studying something like this, I never thought of it. I mean, I know we talk about it all the time, but to really think about it, like, do I do this without knowing?
Well, that's it. It's a way of knowing yourself, or a way of knowing human nature, and to recognize it. You're not in trouble, I hope. You're not in trouble for that.
Hopefully our teachers will tell us.
Yeah. Nicely, or else I'll cry. Yes.
You said something, it's a community something.
Epiphany. Oh, communal epiphany, yeah.
Thank you. I'm part of hearing too, but I'm not honest with myself. I should be. I just wanted to hear that again, and just to say that I was so intimidated to come to a Zen sashimi, because it's very disciplined, and just from what I know from not knowing. you know, I've just been so grateful. I mean, every time Andy speaks, I'm just so comfortable and just right with you, and not that it's a contrast. I mean, the discipline and what we're learning here is really hard for me. It's been hard for me not to talk, mostly to praise. Or, I mean, I think of it as gratitude. That was really good food. I can't imagine going about our day without saying that on some level. I know I could probably say it quieter. But I'm also grateful that, because some of the leaders here are talking, grappling with what do we mean by this rule, and I hear you're saying it, you know, it depends, or it's in context, or, and I'm grateful for that, because, anyway, I can recognize that Andy's got a very unique, soft approach, and it makes it easy to come into this discipline and sit and just have the heart opening and the kind of harsh reality that is sitting in. I don't know, I guess I'm just saying, you know, I'm grateful that you're having this impression on us.
So it's all of us, and that's a good place for us to end, I think.